This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Maybe you heard our recent interview with Jill Bolte Taylor or read her best-selling book about her stroke. Taylor describes how the hemorrhage in the left side of her brain affected her powers of perception, memory, and speech. We wanted to hear more about the functions of the left and right hemispheres of the brain, so we invited Dr. Michael Gazzaniga. He's been conducting split-brain research for the past 45 years. The left and right hemispheres each have different functions and are connected through a pathway called the corpus callosum. Gazzaniga has studied patients with epilepsy whose corpus callosums were surgically severed in an attempt to prevent seizures from traveling across one hemisphere to the other. This allowed Gazzaniga to study the right and left hemispheres independent of each other. He's done similar perceptual research with people who have brain lesions or suffered strokes that made parts of one hemisphere dysfunctional. Gazzaniga is the director of the SAGE Center for the Study of the Mind at the University of California, Santa Barbara. His new book is called Human, The Science Behind What Makes Us Unique. Michael Gazzaniga, welcome to Fresh Air. Why have you devoted so many years to studying the split brain? What are some of the mysteries that these studies can answer?
If you have ever seen a split-brain patient perform a psychological act, you would quickly know why. Every time they do it, it's intriguing. When you see one half brain do something the other side knows nothing about, when you can then use these patients to see the specific functions of each hemisphere and discover kind of how our own brains are organized through that method, they remain extremely helpful in helping us to see our way to understanding the human condition.
Would you describe how the brain is anatomically split and how it's connected?
Sure. So we all know we have the left brain and the right brain, and what the normal organization is that those two brains are interconnected by a great big structure called the corpus callosum, 200 million neurons and so forth. And so each side keeps the other side up to date with through that avenue. And what you have at conclusion of all that is the left brain is your dominant hemisphere. It's the one with your language and speech. It's the one that does the heavy hypothesis making that we all do as humans. And it also controls the right half of your body. And conversely, the right hemisphere controls the left half of your body, senses the left part of your visual field and all this kind of stuff. But it also has specializations. It seems to be superior in perceptual grouping kind of things. That means you can imagine a deer sort of walking through the forest and the trees are actually cutting it off as you stand back. And yet you know it's a deer because you integrate the information across those blank spaces and see that it's that kind of object. And it may be specialized for other things like managing attention, like modulating your emotional system and so forth. So the two sides of the brains are two sides of the brain have these major different functions, and then by testing patients who have this surgery that divides their hemispheres, you can then see even further truths about how the left hemisphere really has this unique feature in the human, which is called that we've called over the years the interpreter. And what it's trying to do is constantly tell the story, build up our own personal narrative as to why things are happening the way they are. And it turns out, after lots of studies, we see that the right hemisphere simply doesn't have one of those things.
So what are some of the more amazing things that you've learned by studying people for whom the left and the right hemispheres of the brain can no longer communicate?
The first thing you notice is there seems to be no difference about them. The case LB, one of the famous cases in the split brain world, was 12 years old at the time, and he woke up from surgery and quipped in the operating room, "I have a splitting headache." And he was very, very quick to just be his own self, and that is generally the rule. So the first thing you learn is that just by general casual clinical exam, you don't notice anything different about the patients, even though their two hemispheres have been disconnected. So it takes you to have the patients, of course, go through a recovery, and then you get them into the laboratory where you start to lateralize information. You start to put information only in one brain or the other brain, and there's very simple tricks to do that. The simplest, if you think about touch, if you grab an apple with your right hand, that information is only going to your left hemisphere. And if you grab it in your left hand, it's only going to the right hemisphere. So what does that mean with a split-brain patient? That means if you put the apple in their right hand and their eyes are blindfolded and you say, what is that? And they say, well, it's an apple, because the information from the right hand goes up the left speech center and they say it, what it is, just like you and I would. So then you put the apple in their left hand and you say, what is it? And at first they might even say, well, I don't have anything in my left hand. And then they start to guess, but they basically don't have any clue what the object actually is. And then they get very clever, and they try to figure it out, because we know their left hemisphere knows they want the answer, so they start banging it on the table, or if it's a pencil, let's say you put a pencil in their left hand, they'll start to dig their fingers in to a sharp corner and try to deduce what it is. So anyway, the point is they're dramatically, with few simple tests, you can see that they're dramatically different, that each hemisphere is independently processing information from the opposite half body.
The people who have split brains as a result of surgery they had to deal with epileptic seizures, they must be really frustrated by the inability, when you're testing them, by the inability to name what's in their left hand. Or, you know, to respond to the things you're asking them to do. Do they face those kinds of frustrations in real life where part of their brain isn't capable of processing what needs to be processed?
Well, it would seem that would be the case. But how it works in real life is they're not in these laboratory situations where we quick flash things to one side or the other, or we put things in and out of the hands and so forth. What happens in real life is we scan our visual environments. We're looking around all the time. Your eyes make tens of thousands of eye movements constantly every hour. We're constantly integrating information into both visual fields, and we look down at our hands. If there's something in it we don't quite recognize by touch. And so, in fact, in the normal course of events, there's virtually no frustration or any sense of that.
You write a little bit about religion in your new book. And do you think that there's a way of examining whether the brain is wired for religion, or a way of thinking about religion as a phenomenon of what the brain does to explain things, to explain the world, to explain existence?
You know, I think this interpreter idea is very helpful in trying to understand religious beliefs. We are belief making machines. We believe in all kinds of crazy things, and there's a whole set of reasons why we do that. But imagine all of a sudden that here we are talking, and we're instantly here on Earth with all of its modern devices and knowledge, and we know them. And we're not burdened with all these religions and the stories of the past and these myths that have come out of history and so forth. How long would it take us to develop them? My guess is that we would invent religion within a month, because we want to invent something that gives an explanation for what this all means, what is the meaning of life. How do we want to deal with sorrow? How do we want to deal with hurt? How do we want to be happy? You name it. Go right down the list of things that we do. We're going to quickly fit those into a system that has some sort of storyline to it. And once you understand that, you realize there have been some terrific stories and rules and all the rest of it that have come down through history. And they play a very important social function and social role to billions of people. So the fact that the modern trained scientist probably is less likely to believe that these are real, there's no question to me that our brains are built to to generate these ideas for social purposes.
So you have studied patients whose left and right hemispheres have been disconnected by surgery that was performed to deal with epileptic seizures. You've studied people who have had strokes. You've studied people who have lesions in their brains, just to see, like, what happens with these dysfunctions, what happens to perception, what happens to speech. Mm-hmm. But now we have imaging as well, imaging of the brain, and you've been working with that too. Can you give us an example of something that you've been able to learn through imaging that you weren't able to learn just by studying people who had various brain dysfunctions?
Yes. Brain imaging allows you to study the kinds of things that humans are hugely engaged in, and one of them is moral beliefs. We as a species decide to do something or not to do something, and one of the things we as a species tend not to do, do not like to do, is kill, or we don't like to steal, or we don't like cheaters, or we don't like any of a variety of these universal things that anthropologists have discovered. And you can now ask the question, well, what is the neurobiology? What is the brain mechanism involved? Indeed, is there a brain mechanism, a detectable brain mechanism? Or are the rules for such kinds of moral beliefs rules that we've learned? And there's just been a lot of recent work in this field, very exciting work, showing that there are so many of our moral beliefs that seem to be a function of built-in mechanisms in our brain.
How do you know that? You do ask people questions about killing and then see what part of the brain lights up?
Well, the design's a little more complicated. There's a famous design that was developed by now an extremely young and still talented neuroscientist, Josh Green, who's now at Harvard, and he introduced the classic trolley problem. You know the trolley problem?
No.
This is very clever. So here's what you have to imagine. A train is going down a track, and it's about to run into five people and kill them. And you have the opportunity to pull a lever and divert the train to another track. The problem is that on that other track is one person. And you will kill that one person, but you'll save the five, okay? So that's a moral dilemma. So you ask people of the world, is it okay to divert the train? And 90% of the people of the world say, yes, that's morally sensible. You're saving five, and you're killing one. So then they change the problem a little bit. They say, okay, you're on a bridge. Train's going underneath the bridge, five people ahead. Train's going to kill those five people, but you have an opportunity to stop it by pushing this fat guy off the bridge. Stopping the train, it's going to kill him, but the other five will be saved. So same outcome. Five are saved, one is killed. Is that morally okay to do? And only 10% of the people of the world say that's morally okay. So from a complete utility point of view, there's no difference in the outcome, but somehow the physical contact of pushing that guy off the bridge makes it unacceptable to everybody in the world. And so they do this in a brain imaging environment, and they discover that on the pushing the guy off the bridge condition, emotional circuitry in the brain lights up. It's like brain breaks for moral acts. And that kind of clever sort of experiment launched now hundreds of experiments where they're looking at how the brain reacts to moral dilemmas.
What about the criminal mind? Has the criminal mind been studied, and are different centers of the brain activated in the criminal mind? Can you see things going on in brain imaging different in the criminal mind?
Well, I'm directing a new project called Law and Neuroscience, and that's at the heart of the project to try to figure out if there are reasons to use brain scans in defense trials of criminals that would help them be exculpable for the crime. That's one question. And the next question is, are these new brain imaging techniques going to be able to determine whether there are differences in psychopaths versus normals, one kind of criminal group versus another kind. The current knowledge on this is from autopsies and, you know, the past, is that you can't find anything in the brains of people who have done horrendous things, serial killers and the like. But so you just say, okay, science wasn't prepared to look at these issues. It didn't have the tools. And now we have new tools, and are we going to be able to do that? The answer is not known now, but we are examining it, and I hope in 3 or 4 years I'll be able to give you an answer.
So if you found that the criminal brain was really different than the average brain, would that be a reason? What would that say in the courtroom about whether the criminal should be serving time in a prison or a mental institution or executed or what?
It's a profound problem. The basic notion is that if we can state that a person committed a crime probably because they had this brain state or probably because of that or that, this or that, or the other thing, then the whole notion of retribution and punishment is up for grabs, right? How can you blame somebody for something they couldn't have helped but do anyway, kind of thinking? The importance of finding out if there is a abnormal brain in the criminal is an important issue for our culture.
Now, what people assume to be true about the left and the right brain is that the right brain is responsible for creativity. So, if you want to be more artistic, you need to learn how to liberate the right side of your brain.
Yep.
Would you say there's any or much truth to that?
We lived through that idea. It came out of the research that Sperry and I started 45 years ago, and it was because there are data that the right side is better at perceptual grouping, but then the idea sort of became hijacked into a kind of a New Yorker cartoon level of. If you're artistic, you're creative, you're right-brained, and if you're logical, linear, you have this linear left brain, and those are half-truths. It is the left hemisphere that is the language, logical, hypothesis-generating hemisphere, and it is true that there are some specialized abilities in the right hemisphere, but I will assure you that your creativity will go to zero if your left brain was damaged. And so it was an overstated view, and it's unfortunate.
So you're not a big fan of the idea that to be creative, you need to liberate the right side of your brain. That's an oversimplification. What about the idea that a lot of people believe that if you're a lefty, it means you're probably a more creative person?
There is good evidence that left-handers tend to be have a higher percentage of architects, higher percentage of people who think spatially, and so is there something tied to that left-handedness and the right hemisphere? It's a story that has good correlational data on it, and there may be something to it. There are all these funny links out there that are really interesting to think about.
If you think that religion is connected to the fact that the left hemisphere of the brain is the interpreter and likes to come up with explanations to explain things, and that would include religion, should I interpret that as meaning that you don't practice one yourself?
That's right. That's right.
Because you think it's a construct of the left brain.
I do, and but I'm not on a rant against them, because if they didn't exist, as I said, we'd invent them. And I'm one of those people that looks at the good that the religions provide and comfort religions provide people. I have no interest in zealotry in religion, and that's where it interferes with advancements. As you may know, I serve on the President's Bioethic Council and the people who religiously based and resisted stem cell research were annoying to me, but that's such a small part of it. The larger part of it is, for instance, who's the largest health provider in the world? It's the Catholic Church. And anybody going to take up that cause? I don't think so. So if you go down and look at all the social goods that religions do, and it's why they get so established in a culture and are passed down, because if you probably look at the total good and comfort versus the times when they're just dead wrong and obstructionist, the comfort time wins. So it's just a question of managing the other stuff.
Well, it's been nice talking with you. Thank you very much.
thank you. My pleasure. Yeah.
Dr. Michael Gazzaniga's new book is Human. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Driving may be one of the most cognitively complex things we do on an everyday basis, but when you're driving in familiar territory, it's easy to drive so unconsciously you're hardly paying attention to the road. But Tom Vanderbilt is paying attention to you. In his new book, Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us, Vanderbilt analyzes many aspects of driving behavior and traffic patterns that we take for granted. He's written about design, technology, science, and culture for Wired, Slate, and other publications. Tom Vanderbilt, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, in your book, Traffic, you've brought together a lot of research about every aspect of traffic, and it's things that you experience every day, but you don't think about in a systematic way. What led you to write the book?
I had a sort of strange moment, but I think that one that almost everyone can identify with. I was driving back to New York from New Jersey and was on a highway, and an orange sign came along warning merge right 1 mile. And this is a two-lane road, so they're asking drivers to essentially, you know, get into one lane eventually at the merge point. And all my life I've been essentially what you might call an early emerger. I was kind of a polite Midwestern type who got over as quickly as possible. I sort of didn't want to anger anyone and avoid the aggravation and not be one of those people that I really resented who tended to stay in that open lane all the way to the end. And I took a Zen approach and, oh, let's just sit back and relax. But one day I was just feeling particularly rushed or frustrated by the number of cars that continued to pass me. So I got out of my early merge situation and jumped back into that open lane, went all the way to the front, merged in. And I felt so guilty about the whole situation that I started looking into it. And in this kind of strange area of traffic engineering, which was a new thing to me, discovered that if the system were set up so that there really were no late or early mergers, everyone just went to that point and merged in turn, the system would process cars 15% faster. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but you know, on today's crowded roads where, you know, we're not building any more roads, we're looking for minor improvements, you know, this could be a huge effect on traffic. And one organization identified merging difficulties was the word they used as the thing that bothered them the most about driving. There's just something unpleasant about merging. And anyway, so I was forced to reconsider my whole notion of what I thought was the right thing to do. And I thought, well, what else about this kind of everyday activity might be, you know, different than I had thought?
So look, getting back to merging for a second, so you're saying that engineers say if we all merged at the same point, traffic would flow more swiftly?
Yes. If people were told exactly to not leave that lane that was closing until the very point when it actually did close, and then we did a kind of nice alternating merge, it would be faster. And another benefit would be the queue of vehicles stretching back from the construction site would be smaller. And the problem with those queues is that often you're coming along the highway at 75 miles an hour and suddenly there's a queue of stopped vehicles, and you are really not expecting that. So that just another strange benefit by what they call this dynamic late merge system. And of course, people do have to still do the right thing at the merge point and allow the other person to do an alternating. You have to let one person in, then go. And the same sort of thing we do, you know, in our normal life, in getting onto an airplane or any situation where you're queuing.
No, something else I experienced that I didn't realize everyone else experiences too, and it even has a name. The name is called the dilemma zone. What is the dilemma zone?
The dilemma zone is when you're approaching a traffic signal and the light turns yellow and you're in that sort of strange moment where you're not sure if you should stop or it may in fact be too late to stop. When they've installed red light cameras, for example, at intersections, which is, you know, something – intersections are quite dangerous. A lot of people are killed and injured at intersections, and one of the reasons is going through red lights. So responded by putting up red light cameras to try to get people to stop. But people then try to stop sooner than they might if they knew they weren't going to get the ticket, and that sort of leads to an increase in rear-end collisions, which some people argue is still a better outcome than the more dangerous side collision if someone is going through the red light. So it's just one of these little – moments on the road where we have to make decisions on the fly based on, you know, kind of a lot of inexact information. We're not robots that can process, you know, distances and time in kind of this mechanistic way. So the dilemma zone is aptly named, I would say.
I'm always afraid in the dilemma zone that if I slam on my brakes, I'll get rear-ended. But if I speed up and try to go through, I not only risk a collision if the light turns green for the traffic going across the other end of the intersection, but I'm also afraid mm-hmm. I'm going to get a ticket. And I'm always preparing my explanation to the cop who I'm sure is going to stop me and say, well, officer, honestly, I thought that if I stopped, I would be in danger of getting into an accident. So I really thought I was being a good Samaritan by speeding up and going through the light. I always have that little speech prepared.
They've probably heard quite a few of those speeches.
Yes, you know. I bet. So is this something that engineers have tried to deal with in the traffic light, of timing it so that you have the maximum amount of warning before entering the dilemma zone?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, sort of algorithms and experiments that have been done to sort of extend the dilemma zone. And I mean, some people argue that, you know, really we should be thinking about, where possible, just getting rid of traffic lights in general and replacing it with something like a roundabout, which is a scary word, I realize, to a lot of Americans. But if you think about a traffic light, you know, that
– describe what a roundabout is.
We as Americans tend to get a little hung up on this old idea of the traffic circle, which was – the first one was in Columbus Circle in New York City, and it was kind of this big – and the Arc de Triomphe in Paris has this situation too. And there's a sort of a bad movie, European Vacation, National Lampoon, which shows Chevy Chase and family kind of stuck in this endless traffic circle until the night falls and he's babbling uncontrollably. But a modern roundabout is just it tends to be no more than two lanes. And, you sort of go in and you – instead of an intersection, you have sort of a circle in the middle and you kind of drive around and then you exit – at the little spoke coming off of the roundabout. And, I mean, the reason they're safer than an intersection, which a lot of people don't want to, sort of challenges their notion, is that there's a number of what they call conflict points in an intersection, places where cars can physically hit another car or a pedestrian. And a standard four-way intersection, it's something like 32 of these points. But in a roundabout, it's cut to 16. There's just fewer chances to hit someone. You're not crossing streams of traffic in a way, and it eliminates the most dangerous move in a intersection, which is a left turn on the green, which I'm sure you've experienced. You do have to, you know, rely a bit more on your own wits and kind of navigate it. And there's an argument that that's what actually helps make it safer, is that you're kind of having to judge other cars rather than just letting the signs do all the work.
There's a lot of places that are putting cell phone laws into effect where either you can't use a cell phone in a car or you can only use a cell phone if you have an earpiece and you're not holding it. And I'm of two minds about this. Like, I know there's been plenty of times I've been crossing the street and looking at the driver in the oncoming car or the driver coming out of the parking spot, and they're on the phone. They are not looking at me. They're barely looking at the road. I know they're completely distracted, and I'm not moving until they pass by. But I confess that I'll speak on the cell phone in my car, although I have an earpiece, so at least my hands are free. But I will dial when stopped at a red light. What are the most dangerous parts of using a cell phone in the car?
Well, you know, now obviously I can't say that don't use a cell phone or you will crash, because we all know we've all done it and we've not crashed. So on the other hand, pilots are in particular are trained to, you know, sort of only use their radios for, you know, mission critical kind of communication. During a landing, they're not calling their wife to see if they need to stop and get milk on the way home. You know, so that just this idea that we don't often know how distracted, and this is another feedback issue, we sometimes don't even know how distracted we are when we're on the phone. We're sort of the worst judge of that. And I did an experiment in a driving simulator in Massachusetts in which I was read a number of statements and I had to kind of read back what had been said to me and, you know, standard psychological sort of stuff. And I had a wireless earpiece cell phone and I was driving on a highway and lo and behold, I smacked into the back of a truck. And when you simulate a truck, of course, and when you go back and look at this, they have eye tracking software that follows where your eyes are looking, kind of pinpoint. When I was on the phone, my eyes were locked just into a laser beam focus on this truck. So, you know, by all intents and purposes, I was, quote-unquote, my eyes were on the road, but my mind was clearly elsewhere. And this seems to be something that's emerging. Scientists have argued to me, you know, it's not about keeping your eyes on the road, it's keeping your mind on the road. And we would be amazed, I think, if any listeners have seen a sort of now famous video that shows a team of people in white T-shirts passing a basketball, and you're asked to count the number of passes that are made. And as this is going on, someone in a gorilla suit strolls right through the group, plain as day, and more than 50% of people do not see the gorilla, and I was one of those people. So it, you know, just sort of reminds you of vision and perception are sort of two different things going on, and we really, if you think about the complicated traffic environment and how many things we're trying to track, and then talking on a cell phone is a bit like counting those passes. It's, you might be having an intense conversation where you're trying to remember something or describe where something is to someone, and that just really uses a lot of what they call workload. It's hard for us to judge exactly how distracted we often are.
For your research on your book, Traffic, you went to a bunch of different countries to see what traffic patterns were like there and what the traffic problems were there. One of the countries you went to is the Netherlands, which is interesting to me in part because there's so many people who ride bikes there. And I know in Philadelphia, where I live, where the streets are very narrow, I often feel very nervous when I'm sharing a street with a bicycle, just because I often feel like there's really not enough room. There's not enough room for us comfortably to drive at the same time. And then, of course, a lot of bicyclists in the United States, with all due respect, don't obey the traffic rules. So sometimes a bicycle shows up where you least expect it. So how does the Netherlands deal with bicycle traffic?
It's a really interesting question, and it's so complicated that I really should write a bicycle sequel, I think. But, you know, the funny thing about the Netherlands is that it has something like 30-odd percent of people use the bike as their everyday means of transportation to work. And in cities, some cities, it's even higher in the Netherlands. And, you know, in the U.S., I think Portland has about a 3-5% statistics, and then Portland is the most bicycle-intensive U.S. city. The Netherlands is funny, though, because people really don't wear helmets very often. They have some of the lowest helmet-wearing rates in the world, yet it's also one of the most safest places to ride a bicycle in the world. And so you talk about narrow streets. You know, the Netherlands, you know, a place like Amsterdam, we're not talking, you know, large boulevards. We're talking about very tight urban streets, which have a lot of bikes and often, in some cases, not bike lanes per se. And so I really think there is something to just the Dutch drivers really have become familiar with the ins and outs of cyclists. And just by dint of seeing them so often have become used to it, just kind of almost a cultural acclimation. And of course, cycling is so universal in the Netherlands. You don't just see sort of people on, you know, in spandex and racing bikes. You know, it's mothers with, you know, toting three children and groceries in the front. And so maybe even in that way, it's just so much more a part of the culture that I think there's people just sort of look out for one another. And, you know, even in Portland, which is a very bicycle-friendly city, there have recently been some road rage cases, to use that phrase, in which bicyclists and cars have kind of gone after each other. And these are ancient issues of just how to share the road. And we think it might be a new phenomenon, but when the bike entered New York City in the 19th century, it was an incredibly controversial device. People who rode horses and carriages hated it. They thought it spooked the horses. Pedestrians didn't want it. Where do you put the bike? Is it in the road? Is it on the sidewalk? So, these are have been with us almost since we began to do anything but walk.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tom Vanderbilt. He's the author of the new book, Traffic, Why We Drive the Way We Do and What It Says About Us. We all have these things that other drivers do that drive us crazy. What's yours? What drives you crazy about other drivers?
I have one that is just a weird thing about being in the left lane and someone behind me wants to pass. They're tailgating me, indicating that they want me to get over, so I dutifully get over and let them pass. And then they move in front of me and then don't maintain the speed they had, and then they end up going slower than I did. So I often find myself in these weird games of passing and being passed by the same driver, sort of dozens of times. And this is what you do on a long, boring drive, I guess. You just sort of play these games with yourself. And that's my pet peeve. I'm sure everyone has their own. Do you have one by chance?
Let me think.
Type of driver? Or?
Well, while you're on the subject of that, it really annoys me when I'm basically going at or slightly above the speed limit. I'm in the left lane because I have to exit left in a couple of minutes. And then there's somebody right on my tail honking the horn, and it's like, quiet down. I'm here because I have to exit. I can't move. And I really can't go any faster, not only because I don't want to, but there's a car ahead of me. So just calm down.
Exactly. And if you sort of surveyed American public driver opinion, getting people out of the left lane who aren't going as fast as you is sort of one of the obsessions of the American driver, I think. And but it's complicated because, like you said, you might have to exit. You might want to try to get past a block of vehicles that you don't want to get right into that right lane. And someone's always going to want to go faster than you. So, the left lane is reserved for faster traffic is not as clear-cut as it sounds. It's a kind of an ambiguous thing that, of course, leads to all sorts of aggravation out on the road.
Oh, here's another pet peeve of mine. The person who thinks that they're really saving a whole lot of time because they're on the highway and they're darting in and out of the left lane, the right lane. They're moving ahead, and they're doing it really quickly too, and maybe not even signaling as they do it. And you have this great statistic in your book about how little time you save, how very little time you save through that kind of driving.
Exactly, both on the highway and even in cities, where there's so many traffic lights, you find yourself being passed by someone and then just rejoining them at the next light. It's so random. And I think a good rule of thumb that's been proposed is the more congested a highway is, the less chance you have to gain by changing lanes. It's every lane is filled. There's kind of what they call an equilibrium. You're not really going to benefit. If this helps keep you awake and keeps you from, if there's a benefit there, that's a good thing. But the moment you change into what you think is the faster lane, you're probably already slowing it down by adding to it, and you might force the person that you've cut in front of to slow down. So it's sort of chasing rainbows, if you will, and we're fighting a losing battle, and the time saved is often very small compared to the added risk you're taking on just by making all these changes.
Well, Tom Vanderbilt, thanks so much for talking with us, and good travels on the road.
Thank you.
Tom Vanderbilt's new book is called Traffic. A few years ago, an American musicologist was looking through forgotten manuscripts in Russia and found the original 1935 piano score to Prokofiev's famous ballet Romeo and Juliet. His discovery revealed significant differences from the more familiar version. The restored score has been choreographed by Mark Morris and was given its world premiere at Bard College earlier this month. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was there and has a review.
Thank you. Here's a story with a happy ending. Sergei Prokofiev's most popular ballet, Romeo and Juliet, was first performed in 1940 and has gone through many different productions, the best known of which is probably the one Kenneth MacMillan choreographed in 1965 for England's Royal Ballet, with Margot Fonteyn and Rudolf Nureyev as the star-crossed lovers. The score is a mixture of memorable tunes, swooning romanticism, savage rhythms, and twinkling wit. At times, the orchestration is also heavy-handed, and there are some dull stretches. But this isn't the music as Prokofiev first conceived it. Princeton musicologist Simon Morrison, going through a neglected archive in Russia, discovered the full piano score to Prokofiev's original version. This includes passages the composer later dropped and has detailed instructions for a lighter, edgier orchestration, more dissonant and more sparkling than his revision. Even more startling was the happy ending, in which Juliet revives from her sleeping potion before Romeo kills himself, and the two rush away to live blissfully ever after in a heavenly musical paradise. All of this was unacceptable to the conservative Soviet censors, who regarded Prokofiev's departures from tradition as decadent. They canceled the ballet and warned Prokofiev it would never be performed unless he changed his plan. And so he did. Musicologist Morrison, a scholar in residence at Bard College in upstate New York, and Leon Botstein, the president of Bard, who is also a conductor, wanted to do a new dance piece to this never-performed score. So Bard commissioned America's most celebrated choreographer, Mark Morris, to do a new full-length dance work that would finally follow Prokofiev's original intentions. Now, with Prokofiev's original title, Romeo and Juliet on Motifs of Shakespeare had its world premiere at a gala performance at Bard on July 4th, and it's a wonderful new addition to the dance repertoire. Prokofiev's original score sounds fresh and vibrant without the labored stretches of the familiar version. One reinstated passage is an amusing series of Middle Eastern dances, the gift Juliet's suitor, Paris, presents her with when he thinks she's accepted his proposal. The happy ending brings together some of the most beautiful music in the score, tender and ethereal. Morris creates a ravishing pas de deux for the reunited lovers. Set against a starry night sky, you wonder if they are, after all, literally in heaven. The entire ballet is gripping and much earthier than previous versions. The opening night lovers, David Leventhal and Rita Donahue, were endearingly passionate. Their first post-coital pas de deux was both sexy and teasing. Mark Morris is famous for breaking the gender barrier in his casting. In Romeo and Juliet, the villainous Tybalt, Juliet's cousin, and Romeo's witty friend Mercutio are both danced by women, with especially dazzling mercurial choreography for Mercutio, danced by the dazzling and mercurial Amber Dara. Both the choreography and the costumes suggest that there is little difference between the Montagues and the Capulets. The warring families dress the same and go through identical expressions of grief. Opening night, the musical performance was a little rough, but Leon Botstein led the American Symphony Orchestra with both vigor and earnestness. He clearly believes in this score and made me believe in it, too.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He teaches English at the University of Massachusetts Boston. Romeo and Juliet on Motifs of Shakespeare will go on tour beginning in September. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.